past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.
Well, it isn't often that we hear that kind of music, that kind of singing on WGTD or on the morning show. We're doing something that is a bit out of the ordinary for us and certainly out of the ordinary for me. But I am genuinely thrilled at this opportunity to speak with D. Randall Bly, who is lead vocal with the heavy metal band known as Lamb of God, a Grammy-nominated group several times over. Renowned throughout the world in the so-called heavy metal community. But D. Randall Bly is joining us on the morning show to talk about the incredible book which he has written, a book called Dark Days. It recounts the incredible story of D. Randall Bly, who upon deplaning with his band in Prague in the Czech Republic, is apprehended and charged essentially with manslaughter for the accidental death of a young man who attended a Lamb of God concert in Prague 2 years earlier than that. That would be back in 2010, and this arrest occurred in 2012. And what followed was an incredible odyssey for D. Randall Bly, taken into custody, suddenly thrown into the Czech legal system, which he barely understood, language barriers on all sides, incredibly terrible conditions, and trying to keep his wits about him, his sanity, trying to just remain afloat, not knowing what was going to happen next. It's an incredible story. It's also not a story that follows necessarily the contours that one might expect. And actually, D. Randall Bly turns out to be an incredibly intelligent and resourceful and decent human being who navigates this frightening gauntlet a lot better than probably most of us would, and live to tell about it and write about it in this book, which, if I understand correctly, is something which he wrote on his own, and it is a brilliant effort. Again, the book, a memoir, is called Dark Days. It is published by Da Capo Press, and I'm very excited to have D. Randall Bly with me on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about his book and his life. D. Randall Bly, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited about this. I have to say, I mean, I'm more of an opera, Beethoven symphony, Mozart string quartet kind of person when it comes to music, but I really try to have the morning show be about more than just the topics that I happen to be personally interested in. So when I undertake something like that, I usually do it out of kind of a sense of moral obligation and coupled with a little bit of a sense of dread. I have to say, your book just really surprised me. I loved it. I read it cover to cover, and I'm really excited to talk about it today on the morning show. Ahead of
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a little bit hard for someone who comes from a heavy metal band to get on an NPR morning show. So I appreciate you taking a chance on me.
Well, as I said, I'm really glad that I did. I've already sketched kind of the heart and soul of what prompted this book to be written, this really frightening experience in Prague. Ahead of us talking about that, I'd like to talk about some of what you discuss in the second chapter of the book, in which you talk about your life as a professional musician and really offer some thoughtful advice to all the wannabes out there who dream of having the life which you are, in fact, living. And I really appreciate a lot of the insights that you share in this chapter. Could we start with this whole notion of being a rock star? That is a label with which you're not fully comfortable, and actually you tell us you prefer the term budget rock star. Tell us, in your mind, the difference between the two, between being a rock star, which a lot of people say you are, and being a budget rock star, which is what you would probably label yourself.
Right. Well, there's a huge misconception amongst most people as to what it is that the vast majority of professional musicians do for a living and how they live. My band, especially in this day and age where record sales have basically disappeared, and the music industry is in serious trouble, my band, we make a very comfortable living. I tour around the world. I've played on every continent except for Antarctica. And I make a decent living. I haven't worried about where my next meal is going to come from in quite some time. But I'm not a millionaire. I don't ride around in a limousine. There's not a gold-plated helicopter coming to whisk me away to the next gig. What I do is go out and play shows for crowds of upward to 100,000 people at some festivals. In reality, where I make my money is for merchandising sales. So basically, I'm a glorified T-shirt salesman. I am a glorified T-shirt salesman who gets to travel the world screaming like a buffoon, jumping around on the stage. The era of the real rock star is fast disappearing, I think. The excess of the 80s has long been over, and there aren't really going to be any more Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelins or any of these sort of mythic, almost mythic beings that these people live these opulent lives of splendor. The system is now failed, and it's not set up to make people incredibly rich and lead these hedonistic lifestyles. What I do is go out on tour and work hard and play shows, you know, 4 to 5 nights a week, all over the world, sometimes in big crowds, sometimes small ones, and I sell a lot of black T-shirts. But I make a, you know, comfortable middle-class living doing this. So, but a lot of professional musicians, even bands with fairly significant fan bases, they can't afford health insurance. A lot of times some people go home and supplement their income working in restaurants or doing construction, both of which I did forever, because those jobs allow you to leave. There's no retirement plan, none of that stuff. And none of us are driving Lamborghinis. So basically, you go out and work hard and try and save some money. But it's not the sort of myth you think of when you think of a rock star. You know, there's people who I sign autographs all the time. There's people who tattoo my portrait on them, as crazy as that seems. But when I go home, I don't have a housekeeper. I mow my own lawn with a push mower. That's a budget rock star.
Right. You tell us that not only do people maybe not always get that. I mean, make all kinds of assumptions about what your daily life is like, but they also have little or no conception about the hard work that is involved in this kind of life. What is the hard work of your professional life that the typical fan just does not begin to understand?
Well, I think to be a successful artist in any of the creative fields, there takes a lot of practice. I did not hatch out of a rock star egg. I didn't suddenly wake up and start touring the world and going on tour with Metallica. I don't know if you're familiar with them at all or just the name. They're, you know, household name, basically, out of the heavy metal scene. We would go out and for 10 years, the first 10 years of our existence, we'd go out and tour and play shows 6 nights a week, 7 nights a week, selling our own merchandise, booking our own tours until we got to a certain point where we could afford to hire management, doing our own press, then coming home and going to another job. I devote a lot, especially in the beginning before I was able to fully make a living at this, I devoted a lot, basically all of my spare time to doing the band. If I was not at work at my restaurant job or my construction job, I was practicing. I have friends I have a good friend who's a professional ballet dancer, and he's 26 years old, and he's successful at what he does. He has a good career, and people see him dance, and he dances beautifully, and they're like, that is just so awesome that you get to be a ballet dancer. They don't see the guy at the end of the day after the show who's just completely wrecked. They don't know, like I do, that he's been doing this since he was 12 years old, honing his craft. You know, it's a craft, not just some sort of free-form creative expression. And being in a band is the same thing. You have to work. You have to practice. We'd practice 5 nights a week for years before anyone cared about us, learning our instruments, learning how to write a song that was catchy to the ear, learning how to craft effective verses to sing, all of that stuff. It's hard work. It's not American Idol. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge, huge misconception with youth today, these reality TV shows. That's not how you make it as a professional musician. You make it by going out and playing to anyone and everyone, which in the beginning is not much of anyone, for years.
And that whole notion of waiting to be discovered and of sort of dreaming yourself into this career, it's just the biggest mistake that someone can make in terms of wasting their time. You also say in this chapter that most wannabe professional musicians are simply not strong enough. What is the kind of strength that probably 95% of aspiring professional musicians lack? Or another way to ask the question is, what kind of strength does it require to make it in this business?
Well, being talented and wanting it are not enough to make it in the business. If wanting something would make it happen, wanting it enough or wishing, I would have been a professional skateboarder at age 14. There would have been Hawaiian Tropic models surrounding me and people handing me trophies. But that's not how it works. You know, instead I'm a 40-some-odd-year-old man who still loves skateboarding. One thing that people don't take into account, beyond the talent, beyond the desire to do this thing, beyond the ability to practice, is the strength to have certainty in what you're doing and not listen to anyone who tells you that you're wasting your time. Because when you are trying to be a professional musician, everyone is going to tell you you're wasting your time. They're going to criticize you. They're going to tell you you have to get a real job. They're going to tell you that you aren't talented enough. They're going to tell you that the odds are stacked against you. And people can be super dismissive. If you don't have a thick skin, that's basically the strength you need, an extremely thick skin, basically an armor-plated skin, and you don't have a chance. The first time you step on stage and someone yells, "You suck," which will happen, by the way, and you internalize that and take that personally, you're done. You know, you're done. So it's a internal certainty, I guess, that at times borders on what some people would call lunacy, I guess, or delusions of grandeur. You have to be certain that this is what you want and that you're going to do it for the love of what you're doing and that you are good enough. And what anyone else says really has no effect on how you live your life.
By the way, you give us a few glimpses into your early life. You're from Richmond, Virginia, originally, I think, and come from what sounds like a very loving family and had a very normal, positive kind of upbringing, it sounds like. What kind of musician were you growing up? In what way was music of interest to you? I mean, did you start out as a band nerd or a choir nerd or something?
I was band and theater nerd. I was first chair flautist for a while.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yes, I can still play a B-flat scale. my father played the banjo. I was in band up until, I don't know, eighth grade, I suppose. And then got really into skateboarding and listening to sort of punk rock music. But growing up in my family, there was a lot of NPR, by the way. The only family vacation we ever took was to St. Paul to see Prairie Home Companion Live. In the fifth grade, I snuck us backstage to meet Garrison Keillor. We still have pictures from that. It was pretty cool. I knew where I belonged from the beginning. But growing up, I suppose, you know, my father was a big jazz fan growing up. He had some Dave Brubeck records. He had a lot of the old Beach Boys records as well. And he had some classical. We listened to a lot of NPR. So, but growing up, beyond the stuff my father listened to, I started listening to some punk rock music at a very young age because I felt it had a bit more gravity than most of the boy meets girl stuff that was on top radio, top 40 radio. It has no interest for me whatsoever. And I don't think there's any reason for really any more love songs because no one is going to be able to top what Motown did in the 60s. You just aren't. You aren't going to write a better song, a love song, than Marvin Gaye or Al Green. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So when I discovered this sort of, you know, underground punk rock scene, I heard some social commentary, some dissatisfaction with the status quo, as it were. And I became involved really in that scene, and I did a couple little bands in high school that never really got out of the garage at all, never played a show. But it wasn't until I went to college, I moved to Richmond from Chesapeake, Virginia, actually, under the auspices of going to school for theater, because I went to a Governor's Magnet School for the Arts for the last 2 years of my high school to study theater. And then I went to college under the auspices of learning, but really I was going to Richmond because it was a bigger city and they had more punk rock shows. So I started a band there, and it never really went anywhere until I joined my current band. And from there, you know, here we are. We formed in 94. I joined in 95. Here we are 20 years later, 21 years later, something like that.
Doing great. And by the way, having just released a new album called Sturm und Drang.
Yes. Good pronunciation.
I'm just curious about your parents, who obviously are open-minded, intelligent people, and who loved you then and love you now. What did they make of this life, which ultimately was yours? I mean, does it make sense to them? I mean, do they ever go and actually hear you perform? I'm just trying to kind of picture your mom and dad at one of these concerts that Lamb of God performs.
You know, here's the thing. I do not blame my parents for the way they viewed what I did until it turned into a profession as being somewhat questionable, right? Because as I wrote, we were discussing earlier, becoming a professional musician is very hard. It's not really what you want your kid to tell you is going to be their career path. What are you going to do? I'm going to be a heavy metal singer. That's not really a viable career option to most parents. So for a long time, you know, I think they were quite worried, basically, like, what are you doing? Why don't you finish your college degree? Why don't you get a real job? You need health insurance. When are you going to grow up? I think sometimes they're still waiting for me to grow up. But my mother has come to see us several times. My father saw us once. I think that was enough for him. they respect what I do. They know that we are very highly respected in our field. And as musicians, they know it's taken them a long while to believe this, but other musicians recognize the technical prowess of my band. It's not easy music to play. It's not just a bunch of screaming, as some people perceive it as. It's really hard music to play. It takes a lot of discipline. So now it's not something they're going to kick back and relax to. on a Saturday evening after a hard week at work, but you know, they're proud of me. They know that what I do is I'm respected for what I do, and it's it takes work. So that being said, it was a bit rough at first on them, I think.
I'm speaking with D. Randall Bly, who is lead vocalist for the highly regarded heavy metal band Lamb of God, and he is also now the author of a really incredible memoir called Dark Days, which principally recounts his ordeal when he is abruptly and quite unexpectedly arrested in Prague just after the plane touches down at the Prague airport. He and his band are there to perform. But instead, D. Randall Bly is taken into custody and charged with manslaughter for the death of a young man at their previous Prague concert 2 years earlier. We'll get to those events in just a moment. Chapter 4 of your book is also a really powerful section in which you say that you've been through two particular circles of hell. And one of those is the experience of alcoholism, a reality with which you live to this very day, although thankfully you've been sober for quite a few years now. You say actually that when it comes to understanding who you are, that really alcoholism is a more important factor than your profession, the fact that you are this well-known and highly regarded singer in a heavy metal band. In what way is alcoholism that has that been such a pervasive element in your life that it really is the single most significant identifying factor for you? That's really a significant thing to say.
Right. Well, I think because I view everything now, thankfully, through the sober, non-drinking eyes of an alcoholic, alcoholic, it shapes the way I look at the world. I drank and did other substances, but drinking was my primary vice for 22 years. And at first, it was just like normal kid stuff, high school kids having a few beers, and I had some fun. And I don't think there's anything wrong with drinking, per se, if you can do it normally. I, however, despite my best attempts to prove otherwise, cannot drink normally. So basically, alcoholism took over my life after I reached a certain point when it switched from drinking for fun, having a little youthful experimentation, until it turned into my late 20s and into my 30s. It was just what I did. I did not like the way the world was, a lot of things about the world, and still don't. I don't think there's anything wrong with viewing injustice in the world and getting riled up about that. But instead of actually effectively trying to do anything about this, or at least raise some sort of positive alternative to anything, I just drank in order to obliterate these feelings of anger or despair at what I perceived as societal injustices and personal problems of mine. You know, anything, everybody has problems. So if something would upset me, instead of dealing with it head on, I would drink. And the thing about drinking for a normal person is that, you know, maybe there's a bit of heartache in your life and you drink one or two nights to get it, you know, get through it. Some people can do that. For me, it just continued on and on and on and on until I had absolutely no control over my drinking. It reached a point where I couldn't imagine life with drinking or life without drinking. And I just become a receptacle for alcohol.
Right.
So I decided I had to put it down.
I remember, I think you describe a point where you just are sitting someplace and you see this shelf with maybe 12 or 13 empty beer bottles, just one next to another, and somehow that was sort of a metaphor for what your life had become. Another interesting moment in this chapter is when you write this, looking about at other people who manage to drink in moderation, people who can drink without becoming a menace to themselves and others. They can take it or leave it. They can drink just one or two beers, then walk away with an enjoyable feeling and not need more. I do not understand this way of thinking or being. Not at all. I always need more. Always.
Intellectually, I know that it is true that some people can have a couple of beers because I see it. Intellectually, I grasp that. The overwhelming... in an abstract way, I understand that the rest of the entirety of my being cannot understand. Literally, I cannot understand why anyone would have one or two beers, and I cannot understand how someone could have half a beer, and set it down. When I'm at a restaurant with friends, and they order a drink and sit there and they drink it throughout the evening, maybe one beer or one cocktail, I almost get annoyed with them. I'm like, aren't you going to drink that thing? Aren't you going to have another? Because that is me. And for me, it's obviously indicative of the fact that I do not process alcohol like a normal person. You know, when I drink alcohol, something changes within me. And anything that happens after I start drinking is a mystery to me, except for the fact that I'm going to drink more, and I'm going to drink until I'm done, or it's gone, or I'm arrested, or I'm in the hospital, or in the psych ward, or, you know, all of these things have happened. All of these things. And it sets off an really uncontrollable phenomenon of craving within me. And the only way I know to not have that occur is just to not take a first drink. And if I don't do that, then I'm fine.
Hmm. I so appreciate that you also make the point in this chapter that the business that you are in your words, is very conducive to nurturing a good case of alcoholism. Booze and drugs are plentiful and often free. I mean, you talk about all kinds of fans and others in your immediate circle who are, you know, ready to buy you a free drink or buy you a free whatever, and it's almost set up for disaster. And it probably makes a lot of sense for anybody going into this business to be really fully cognizant of just what a risky business it is in this respect.
Sure. I think, you know, there's alcoholics in every profession, every single profession. And the one thing I say in my book, I'm a garden variety drunk. I am. I'm not special. My job doesn't make me special. It doesn't make me more prone to alcoholism or anything like that. The one thing that is a little unique about my business is that crazy drunken behavior, stereotypical quote-unquote rock star behavior, which often includes substance abuse, is entirely expected. It's almost, and not almost, but in many cases, it's celebrated. There's memoir after memoir written of rock and roll debauchery tales, you know, tales of excess. And people like to look at that from the outside, I think, and almost in a voyeuristic, watching a train wreck kind of way. They like to look at these stories and, you know, maybe live a little bit vicariously that way. From the inside, it can be deadly if you are prone to addiction or alcoholism, because the fact of the matter is that most of the time, if you can get up on stage and do your job, no one in the industry is going to reach out to you and stop you. And if you do something objectionable, it just becomes fodder for gossip. If I was worked in an office and I showed up on the job completely drunk, just once, I'd be fired. But that's not the case in rock and roll in the music industry. People are like, oh yeah, it's a heavy metal show. Of course he's drunk, you know? So it is conducive to allowing alcoholism to flourish. But if it's there, it's going to be there no matter what your profession is.
Thankfully, you, as we said, have been sober for quite some time now, and I so appreciate the attention with which you give this important matter in your book. Did it feel okay to write about it? Does it feel okay to answer questions about it? I only ask that because I've had this experience on several occasions of talking to people who have had either serious drinking or drug problems and have written about them, and I always, there's this tiny part of me that worries about asking too many questions, wondering if just the act of sort of dredging up this aspect of their past is going to somehow dredge it back into existence, if you know what I mean.
It does not bother me in the slightest. And the fact of the matter is that within my genre, I was already well known as a complete disaster, as a total alcoholic. It was no big secret to anyone. And in this era of social media and YouTube videos and all that stuff, I mean, thousands of people have seen me act like an idiot drunk. There's no hiding it. So for me, even if that weren't the case, I don't think I would have a problem talking about it at all, because when I wrote that chapter in that book about alcoholism, I did try and explain it to the lay person, earth people, as we like to call non-alcoholics, you're normal, we're from another planet, so that they could maybe understand what it was like. But I primarily wrote that chapter for people who suffer from alcoholism and who may be wondering, what in the world is wrong with me? Why can't I stop drinking? Because for me, it took a while to quit, and I didn't understand why I couldn't just stop. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know that it had taken over my being, and it had really given me no choice, because as long as I was putting it in me, alcohol was controlling me. It wasn't a matter of, any sort of moral weakness. I wanted to quit for years. I had to get help, you know, eventually, but I didn't understand why I couldn't just stop. Why can't you just put it down? People ask me that. Everyone asks me that. Why can't you put it down? I just couldn't. That's because I didn't understand the overwhelming effect that alcoholism has on a person, how it just makes them do crazy things. I would wake up after nights of drinking and remember with great shame some sort of idiocy I had engaged in, and ask myself in the morning, why would you do that? It's not something I even wanted to do. As you said, I was raised by very moral parents, very caring people. It's not like I was abused. It's not like anything. I had some sort of huge traumatic moment that caused me to turn to drink. I certainly drank myself into the point where I couldn't stop. I had no one to blame for that but myself. But I never, when I was little, wanted to say, I want to grow up and be an alcoholic and not be able to control my drinking. You know, I never said that. I never said I want to disappoint my family, worry my mother, worry my wife, ruin my marriage, all of that. I never said I wanted to grow up and act like a jerk when I'm drunk. Nobody says that, but I did. So it wasn't until I grew to understand that, hey, this is something that you have to address, generally with help. Some people can quit on their own, but something you have to address and have to get some help for, because you're completely out of control. It wasn't until I understood that I was able to stop drinking. And when I wrote that book and I'm public about it, it's so that maybe someone who's reading that can understand, okay, I'm not alone. I'm not completely nuts. Because that's how you feel. When you're drinking and your life is going down the tubes, you feel insane. And as odd as it is to everyone on the outside, they're like, he should stop drinking. You can't process that, you know. And generally, someone with experience can talk to someone else having problems. And help them sort of see the light, as it were. So I'm hoping my book might be able to help somebody.
Sure. And you write in this chapter, it has been one of the greatest unexpected joys of my life as a sober man to talk about my past life to friends I have made in sobriety. For those of you just joining us, I'm talking with D. Randall Bly. He's the lead vocalist for the heavy metal band Lamb of God, and his new memoir is called Dark Days. Well, that's what we have to talk about now, that moment on June 27th, 2012, when a plane lands in Prague. You and your bandmates are there to perform, but almost from the moment you enter the airport, you are taken into custody and questioned and ultimately led away, arrested for something which had occurred 2 years earlier. You were essentially charged with manslaughter for helping to cause the death of a young fan who was at that concert back in 2010. It's, of course, an incredibly bewildering turn of events, that and being interrogated and then incarcerated. That'd be scary enough in your own country amidst your own language. But for that to happen in the Czech Republic, it's just hard to imagine just how frightening that had to be. Tell us, first of all, because you had been arrested before, you'd been put in jail before during some of your rougher days. You said sometimes being thrown in jail was sort of a relief sometimes, a break from whatever was going on. But this felt completely different from any of the other times that you had ever been arrested and or thrown into jail.
Right. Well, you know, when I've been arrested before, I'm not some sort of habitual career criminal. We were just discussing alcoholism. Drunk people tend to get arrested if they're out in public sooner or later. You know, public intoxication. I've been locked up for being intoxicated and doing ridiculous things while intoxicated, some of them not so savory. But generally, you know, you wake up in jail in the drunk tank in the morning and you know you're going to get out soon because you got drunk and did something stupid. When I went to jail in the Czech Republic, though, it was an entirely different matter because, as you were saying, it's a foreign country. People aren't speaking my language. The charges they had given me had been translated from Czech into English. They handed me a sheet of paper at the airport before they carried me away, and it wasn't in the best, most, I guess, clear English at times. And I didn't know when I was going to get out. They handed me this sheet of paper saying that I was to be held responsible for killing a young man. That's a little bit different than waking up in the drunk tank in Richmond and going, oh, I got drunk last night and wrecked my scooter in front of the police station, which of course happened. That's a little bit different. You wake up and you're like, wait a minute, I've never even attempted to kill anyone, much less actually succeeded. And it was very different for me because I had been sober for a while when I was arrested. I wasn't, you know, I was a sober man by then. So it was very, very bewildering to me. It was, I kept on looking around at times almost in the beginning for the hidden camera. Like, okay, so, you know, someone is really, really pranking me right now.
Right.
This isn't funny anymore.
Yeah,
this is
and
not
I'm...
funny. I'm sitting in a jail cell in a foreign country. This is not amusing. Okay, somebody pop out from behind the door. That didn't happen. It was very real.
One of the things
it was a matter of processing it.
Right. One of the things you tell us is that among the biggest disappointments and sources of frustration early on was the really rather negligible help that you were given by the American embassy there. And you kind of spell out the expectations, which probably most of us have, about what the American embassy is in a position to do for an American who finds themselves in this kind of situation. And the help that they were able to offer you was just about nil. tell us about that.
Well, what happened was I was arrested. First of all, I think you have to put things in context. In 2010, when this young man had died, there was an investigation launched into his death. And the Czech government contacted the American Justice Department and said, we would like to investigate this Randy Bly guy on manslaughter charges. There's a young man, and it looks like he killed him. We went to investigate him, and the American government said, no, we're not going to do that. They looked at the whole thing, I guess, or someone just made an arbitrary decision that they weren't going to cooperate. So they said, no, we won't cooperate with your investigation. I guess they didn't deem it worth their time, and they neglected to inform me. Both the Czech government and the American government neglected to inform me that I was wanted for manslaughter. Right from the beginning, when I found that out, it kind of ticked me off a bit, because if the IRS can find me, and they certainly can, but the Justice Department can't, then our country's in bigger trouble than I thought. So a period of 2 years passes where it is known to our government that the Czechs want to investigate me, that I'm wanted in a foreign country. I'm a touring musician. I travel around the world. They could have let me know so that I could have addressed this matter on my own, even if they weren't going to cooperate with the Czech government. Instead, they neglected to do so. And I've never gotten a satisfactory answer as to why that is out of them. And then as far as the embassy goes, when I was arrested, I asked the officer, I said, am I going to be, I need to call my embassy. Obviously, I'm in a foreign country. And they said, yes, this will happen. So eventually, when I was in jail the day I was arrested, the embassy called me. And I think everybody who's watched movies thinks that there's going to be some sort of, as an American, perhaps we're prone to American exceptionalism, but you think someone from the embassy is going to show up and give you some sort of advice, maybe give you some insight into your situation, if they have an embassy in the country in which you're arrested, and of course they do in the Czech Republic. Instead, I got a phone call that said, hey, how are you? And I said, I'm not doing too well. I'm not really sure what's going on at the moment. Are you guys going to send someone down here? And they're like, sometime tomorrow we will. We're kind of closed for the day today. And I was like, well, what about a lawyer? And they're like, well, we can't really give you any legal advice, which is pretty shocking to me. I wasn't expecting them to scramble SEAL Team 6 in a Comanche attack helicopter, a Tomahawk to come get me or anything. But I thought maybe they would send a lawyer down. I would think that the embassy would have some sort of judicial representative in that country who at least understood the legal code, who could come and explain. They gave me a list of lawyers who had worked with Americans before. They wouldn't recommend one in particular. They asked me, they said, they did ask me if I was being tortured. I said, are they torturing you? I said, no. And they said, are they going to feed you? And I asked them, I said, are you going to feed me? They said, yeah, we'll feed you. I said, no. They said, okay, well, there's not much we can do then. And the next day, a woman from the embassy came and she talked to me about what information I would allow the embassy to release to the press, which I told them none, basically, because I didn't know what was going on. And it's better to keep things as close to the chest as possible so there's no misunderstanding or misinformation gets out. And they were on their way, and that's the only time I saw them up until my trial. The woman from the embassy representative, did keep my family informed to the best of her knowledge of what was going on. But there was really not much help from the embassy. A British prison watch group came and checked on me when I was in prison. A group of people, well-dressed people, came in and, are you David Blythe? And I'm like, yes, sir. We're a British prison watch organization here to check on the welfare of our citizens locked up abroad. I said, you know I'm not British, right? Yes, but you speak English. I'm like, okay. So I talked to them. Yeah, any of the information that my wife found useful concerning my incarceration, visitation, how to send a package to me, anything about the prison in general, she found from a British website, a British government website. The embassy and the American government didn't really seem to be too bothered, it would appear. I mean, there was a White House petition that eventually, I forgot to write about this in the book, but there was a White House petition that had got enough signatures that the White House eventually had to make a statement concerning my incarceration, a fan to my ban. had a petition made, and eventually the White House said, we're monitoring the situation. But that was it.
Wow. We're speaking with D. Randall Bly, lead vocalist for the heavy metal band Lamb of God, and we're talking about his memoir, Dark Days, which primarily recounts his ordeal of being abruptly, quite unexpectedly, arrested in Prague of the Czech Republic, charged with manslaughter for an incident which had occurred 2 years ago. The book is about that incredible and frightening experience. More from D. Randall Bly, author of Dark Days, on tomorrow's morning show here on WGTD.